right, welcome to the Mobility Podcast. I am your co-host, Pete Gould from Shared Mobility Strategies, and I'm joined by my other co-host,
Greg Rogers with Securing America's Future Energy, or SAFE. And since our co-host, Greg Rodriguez from BB&K, isn't here, I will say on his part, views are our own.
And today, I'm very excited. We've got a great guest with us today. Harry Campbell, or as many of you might know, the rideshare guy, has joined us and is going to talk about mobility and shared mobility and TNCs from what is amazingly, I think, the least covered perspective is the drivers. I just want to, A, welcome Harry to the show. I had the chance to meet up with Harry when I was out in LA. He is a super chill, super smart, super entrepreneurial guy, and it's really exciting to be able to have him on the show. So, Harry, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm glad to be here. Definitely, like you said, we met up in LA, and I think I've been eager to make it onto the podcast ever since. So I'm glad we could all work it out, and I'm ready to chat some Uber and Lyft and whatever else, whatever other topics we can go from there.
Perfect. Yeah. No. So I guess we'll start with the kind of worst opening interview question ever, and just tell us about yourself. I'm bad at this, but also because I think you do have a fascinating story, and it'll really help kind of open up into the broader conversation.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, I think that, you know, the best way to sum it up is I started out as an engineer. So I was an aerospace engineer working for Boeing, basically doing the exact opposite of what I do right now and sort of my current role and duties. But, I was working full time as an engineer. I heard about driving for Uber and Lyft. I had taken it a few times as a passenger, but I sort of started talking to some drivers. And this was about 5 years ago. So Uber, to give a little perspective, Uber was worth a few billion dollars at the time, you know, only a few billion dollars at the time. They maybe had 100,000 drivers. And, you know, I like to say that people were just starting to hear of it. You know, your friends were riding it and, you know, people were just starting to say, hey, this is, you know, the buzz was starting to spread. And so that's kind of really when I got in with what I would say was kind of the ground floor of driving for Uber and Lyft. And I pretty quickly realized that, you know, this isn't rocket science being an Uber or Lyft driver, but it's also not the easiest job in the world. And, you know, I wanted to start blogging about my experience as a driver, how much money I was making, what it was like to work for Uber, how Uber and Lyft were different, how to interact with passengers. And that's really kind of the evolution of how I started my blog and then YouTube channel and podcast and all the other properties that we have from there. But, you know, eventually, obviously, Uber continued to grow. I got in at a very good time, and I eventually left my full-time job as an engineer to do this full-time. So I've now been running the blog and running my online media business for the past few years.
That's awesome. Feel free to shamelessly plug. Harry's got a great new book out. It's called The Rideshare Guide, Everything You Need to Know About Driving for Uber, Lyft, and Other Ride-Sharing Companies. And so your book is all about helping TNC drivers make more money. And we often hear about driver incomes and the economics of ride sharing as if it is a fixed, almost like a wage type thing of, you know, there's X price and X cut that Uber takes, and thus here's how much drivers make. But the point of your book and what it really outlines is that there's a lot of strategy to this. You know, it's not just turn on the app, click yes, and follow the directions. And so let's start with, what are the top ways that like a driver can improve their earnings, you know, driving for Uber or Lyft or both, et cetera?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. And one thing, you know, like many other things in life, how much an Uber or Lyft driver makes is a complicated topic. And I think that a lot of people want to say, oh, you know, drivers make this or they make that. But really, I mean, the answer is that it's variable, you know, depending on a few major factors. And I would say the number one thing is sort of where you're driving, right? So if you're in a city like San Francisco or even LA, the demand is just so much higher. And what that creates is lots of bonuses for drivers to get on the road, lots of surge pricing, you know, and there isn't as much competition between drivers for rides. So, you know, obviously not everyone can control where they live, but the second factor that comes into play is when you drive. And I think that's the other unique thing that starts to get into some of the flexibility of driving for Uber and Lyft, and which, you know, when we survey drivers, when I talk, you know, I probably talked to tens of thousands of drivers over the past few years. And the two things that always come up are pay and flexibility when you ask drivers why they're doing this job. Obviously pay, you know, no one's going to do this job for free, but at the same time, you are flexible to do it whenever you want. You might be able to make the most amount of money Friday, Saturday nights, staying out till 3 or 4 a.m., but not everyone wants to do that. That doesn't work with everyone's schedule. And so I think those are the kind of the two things that, you know, you may be able to make only, let's say you're a driver and you're in a smaller city and you can only drive weekday afternoons and you can only make 10 or 12 bucks an hour. But at the same time, you can work every single afternoon, or you can work, you can take 3 months off and then you can go back and work a Tuesday afternoon. You know, that type of scheduling flexibility, I think, is pretty unrivaled. And I would say that's definitely, you know, one of the positives. I'm sure we'll talk about some of the downsides at some point in the podcast. But, you know, right now, I think I'll definitely sell the earnings and, you know, the kind of expectations. But, you know, I think definitely for drivers, average drivers are earning, they report earning around $16 to $17 an hour before expenses. Drivers do have to pay for gas and their own vehicle and things like that. But as you might imagine, basically, the busier place and the busier times, the more you can make. And that's kind of what my book sort of helps set the stage and really just set realistic expectations for drivers.
That's fascinating.
I actually spent 6 months as an Uber and Lyft driver during a career transition in 2015. Like any good millennial, I wanted to quit my job and go follow my dreams of becoming a self-driving car blogger. Everyone thought I lost my marbles, and I still think that I probably have. But one of the great things was that Uber and Lyft gave me the flexibility to be able to drive during the day, blog whenever it wasn't busy, and then be able to go to receptions and start networking and things like that. And there's no way you can have that flexibility any other way than Uber and Lyft, really. And I wish I would have had Harry's book at that time, because I spent so much time with spreadsheets trying to figure everything out until I ended up finding his blog, which was really helpful. So I'm excited to see how this book is going to help drivers to earn as much as they can.
Yeah, I think that's really was the impetus for me writing the book. You know, I've been blogging and covering the industry for 5 years. And during that time, you know, me and now my team of writers, we produce hundreds of articles, you know, dozens of podcasts, and probably hundreds of videos too, about anything and everything Uber and Lyft and driving and everything related to that. But as you might imagine, it's a lot of content. And so for me, the book was really just organizing it all into the best and most pertinent information all in one place. And that's kind of the goal of the book. It was a fun project because every time I sat down to write, it was, you know, I wasn't running into writer's block. These were topics I've covered before, but it was sort of, you know, that new driver who's maybe 1 week in, or, you know, doing their research, or a month or two in and trying to figure things out. That was sort of who I wrote the book for, and just kind of giving them a crash course so that they didn't have to spend, you know, dozens of hours or hundreds of hours reviewing everything. And, you know, I think that's kind of, I definitely feel like that was the end result. And so far, the feedback has definitely been positive. And even from a lot of people in the industry too, that kind of want to learn, you know, about what it's like to be a driver and just learn about the companies from the worker's perspective. Because I think that's one of the biggest takeaways I've had in 5 years of doing this, is that you can learn a ton about these companies just by working for them as, you know, their independent contractor or driver or delivery person.
What I always remember that was fascinating was that in my time when I was there, that there was actually a hard rule at Uber that you were not allowed to be a Uber driver.
Yeah.
The case was something along the lines of the independent contractor employer type of issue.
I know they had that rule for a while because of the lawsuit that they were facing. And so they kind of didn't want to blur the lines there. I think they've figured it out now. Now they've got a bunch of, you know, when I meet with people at Uber, you know, they've got a bunch of people telling me, oh, you know, I'm driving, I'm doing this, and I'm learning so much. And I say, yeah, man, you know, if you guys would have done this 5 years ago.
No, it's fascinating. It's one of those that, because they also get, so basically their insights into the driver experience was through kind of the support tickets, which you then deal with, well, how valid is this complaint, blah, 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 or is he just complaining, versus doing it yourself is an invaluable experience. So, and again, I think that one of the reason I really wanted to have you on the podcast too, is that I think that the same goes for policymakers. Talking about ride sharing, talking about advocating on behalf of drivers without actually having a real voice from drivers, it is, I think, difficult. And so I think one of the big TNC related policy battles that has been in the news lately is in New York City. And so, you know, going back to your comments about there's ways to make better or worse money, New York City had kind of a two-pronged major policy change recently. One was setting basically a minimum wage for drivers. And so I'd love to get your take on that concept. And then next, we could talk about the broader for-hire vehicle or Uber cap in terms of new drivers.
I would love to. And I think that's one of the reasons why I was so excited to come onto your podcast, because I do think that, you know, a lot of the people around the industry, especially on the policy side, have very good intentions for drivers. But, you know, I see so many conferences and panels. And Pete, I know I joked with you recently about one that was sort of like about the experience of workers or about the experience of drivers, but there wasn't a single driver on the panel.
It's like those all male panels talking about women in transportation. Yeah.
I really like the minimum wage sort of idea behind this New York bill, because one thing that Uber and Lyft drivers and the companies are always at odds when it comes to really the number of drivers on the road and sort of that saturation level, right? Because me as a driver, I actually want as few drivers on the road as possible. I want as many passengers requesting, because what that means is there's going to be more surge pricing. There's going to be more requests coming in. So my utilization is going to go up and I have more rides to choose from, right? It's sort of just like, you know, imagine when you go fishing, right? You obviously want to go fishing in the place where all the fish are, right? And so as a driver, that's what I want. But Uber and Lyft really want the opposite. They're sort of, you know, one of the number one metrics in the business is sort of that ETA, right? Mm-hmm. So when a passenger requests a ride, how far away is that driver? 2 to 3 minutes is sort of ideal. I mean, anything shorter than that is almost too fast that the passengers aren't ready to go, but 2 to 3 minutes, 2 to 4 minutes is always ideal. And, you know, in order to do that, they need a lot of drivers on the road and evenly spaced and evenly distributed. And so I think that, you know, those sort of two different incentives always mean that, you know, drivers are going to want as few drivers on the road as possible. And Uber and Lyft are really going to want as many drivers on the road as possible. And I think that's sort of what has happened here in New York, where obviously there are 12 or 13,000 taxi medallions before Uber and Lyft, which was not nearly enough. And now there's 60,000 Uber cars on the road and 30,000 Lyft vehicles on the road, or something like that. And so you start to see that, hey, almost too much of a good thing can be bad, especially on the driver's side. And that's really a lot of the complaints we're hearing from drivers, that it's not as busy anymore. You know, they have to work longer hours in order to get more fares and there's more competition. So that's sort of a little bit of my take on New York. I'm happy to go into more detail though.
You know, yes, the completely unregulated go ahead, there are inevitable consequences, you know, of kind of flooding the zone. It always felt that so much of the taxi industry is the kind of archaic regulations, you know, that opened the door for Uber from the customer demand side, were built around that concept of what's in the taxi companies, less so the taxi drivers per se, but like the taxi industry's best interest, rather than what is the best way to operate from a both the drivers and the passengers and the broader kind of public, you know, broad public interest of how do you want access to mobility. Because, you know, when you saw with New York, you have the hard cap at a, you know, comparatively low number, as we're, I think, really being, we're seeing with Uber and Lyft's growth. What it meant was that you just couldn't get cabs in places other than when all the cabs flooded to the most popular densest zone. And that goes into the, you know, on the issue of a hard cap. You know, I'd love to get your take in terms of, yes, that's obviously what is in every current Uber or Lyft driver's best interest. What about the next kind of way, like the, what would be the next, not even generation, but, you know, someone who say is either in between jobs and is trying to go out on their own, but wants to do this to, you know, for all of the benefits and reasons that you did. Is that fair to them, would you say? Or is it kind of at some point you need to pull up the ladder?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that it's a tough issue because for sure for drivers, I mean, once you become a driver, you sort of, you know, you don't think about that next driver that's signing up or applying. But I mean, definitely one of the things we hear from a lot of new drivers is, I mean, there are a ton of people that, you know, maybe can't, I've spoken with a lot of older drivers who maybe got laid off or can't find work elsewhere. And driving for Uber and Lyft, one of the best things about working for these companies is that they don't discriminate based on age, sex, religion, anything like that. They will hire anyone and everyone, which is a great thing when you're first getting started. And I think it does create some problems down the road because of that unrestricted growth potential. And so I think really the ideal solution is something in the middle, right? When I think we've seen that when the government, you know, kind of comes in and does, okay, 13,000 taxi medallions, that's not anywhere near enough. But also when you sort of let Uber and Lyft go and do whatever they want, they might tell themselves that they have the driver's best interest at heart. But I think that, you know, overwhelmingly drivers disagree. And so I think kind of as long as you understand both sides of the equation, I think then the regulators and the policymakers can go in and set that middle ground, right? I mean, kind of expecting, and I think a lot of the transportation experts, you guys probably know better than me, but as far as congestion, you know, I think that there's no doubt in my mind as a driver that Uber and Lyft are making congestion worse, but there was also a ton of traffic before Uber and Lyft. So, you know, kind of capping the number of vehicles isn't going to do anything there, but I do think there are some benefits on the minimum wage side. So I guess what I would say is sort of, you know, some cap, I think makes sense, you know, sort of with the input of drivers and Uber and the government, but anything on the extreme end doesn't. I mean, 60,000 cars, I think, is a lot of cars. And, you know, these companies are creative. Uber and Lyft are creative. You know, they're already talking about having existing drivers rent out their vehicles to new drivers, for example, because it's not a cap on drivers. It's actually a cap on the number of vehicles. And so when I hear stuff like that, I say, hey, that actually sounds pretty good to me as a driver. You know, now on the Saturday and Sunday when I don't drive, some other driver can go and rent my vehicle and I can get paid sort of semi-passive income. Why didn't Uber and Lyft think about this before? You know, this cap has actually forced them to innovate and innovate in a way that benefits the driver. And I think that's really been one of my biggest gripes with the companies along the way. But, you know, UberPool was this innovative, sort of shared, you know, option that they introduced, but they actually paid drivers less when they introduced it. So it was like passengers were saving money, Uber was, you know, gaining all this goodwill, and now drivers were sort of the ones shouldering all of that. So that's just sort of what I think has happened.
Yeah, that's actually one of the things that sort of it pushed me out of it was that UberPool and Lyftline came around and I started doing a few rides and I picked up a new job, but it was just a pain at first trying to, first of all, educate riders when they were first learning about UberPool and Lyftline. They were shocked. They thought, oh, I was getting a cheaper ride. I didn't know I was actually going to be sitting in a car with another stranger.
Yeah, so I think definitely the rider education component of UberPool and Lyftline, especially early on when these companies were just launching them for the first time. I mean, now most of the major cities have all these different shared options, but when Uber and Lyft were first launching these products, they didn't do the best job of rider education, and a lot of that responsibility was left to drivers. And so I think that's kind of where you start to see some of the mismatches between the products that are being released at the TNC level and then how they play out in reality. Me as a driver, I'm getting passengers who didn't realize they were calling an UberPool. You know, they were motivated. They just wanted the cheapest option, right? That's what ended up happening. A lot of people saw, oh, you know, I could get this ride that's the cheapest. They don't look at anything. They don't read. They don't think because Uber is so easy and they just pick the cheapest one and they get in. And then, like you say, Greg, you know, someone else gets into the car and they say, hey, what the hell is going on?
Yeah. Or they see the lower price and it's like, well, that's only if you get matched. And it's like, okay. And then when they actually are about to get matched, they're like, well, hold on, can you cancel that? It's like, no, this is the deal you made.
I think UberPool is just one of those examples where I think it has great intentions as far as sharing rides and all that. But I think the way that it's played out, Uber is losing and Lyft are losing a ton of money on these shared rides, even though it's a somewhat mature product. I mean, it's 3 or 4 years old, I think, in some cities, or 2 or 3 years old. They're still losing a lot of money on these rides. And I think Americans in general just aren't that keen on sharing. That's definitely been my experience as a driver, is exactly what you said, Pete. I mean, people, they get in, they pick UberPool because they can save money, but they get pissed when they match with someone or, you know, they're in a hurry on the way to the airport and they say, can you drive faster? And I say, dude, you called an UberPool.
The point about losses that you make is really the key here, because it has to be a low enough price point or price advantage or discount to me, the rider, for me to agree to do that, because knowing that there's a greater likelihood that it's going to take longer to get there, it'll be out of, and there's uncertainty. But also, you know, in theory, when it was initially announced, it was like, oh, this is, you know, the way Uber played it was, this was great for drivers because you're basically like double stacking fares. But that's clearly not the case. No one's going to pay the same fare to go out of their way and have a longer and less reliable thing. And so, where is that trading point?
Yeah, I think their idea is more of the chain ride. So, for example, you pick up a passenger at point A and then grab another passenger along the way. You drop someone off and then you go even a little bit further, right? But what's ended up happening with UberPool and Lyftline for the most part is you're picking up two passengers in about the same area and dropping them off in about the same area. So a majority of the trip, they're both in the car. And the way that drivers are paid on Uber Pool and Lyft Line is they're paid per mile and per minute. And Uber, over time, they've added, for example, now they give you 50 cents extra when you pick up another passenger. But I think they really kind of botched it from the beginning. They actually paid drivers less per mile and per minute for Uber Pool than they did for UberX. And, you know, as any driver can probably tell you, the toughest part about driving for Uber and Lyft is the pickup and drop off. Driving 45 miles an hour down the street with two passengers, that's the easy part, right? It's the picking up in San Francisco, you know, where you can't pick up on Market Street, or it's the dropping off, you know, in LA in the bars, you know, in the bar area where there's cops just like ready to give you a ticket and you have passengers who are intoxicated and they want to be dropped off right in front of the bar, but there's no parking spots. So you sort of have to make that choice. Do I want to double park or do I want to, you know, loop around the block? Oh, and they get to rate you at the end of the ride too. So you sort of, you can't be, you know, completely deaf ears, right, to what they want and what they're doing. And, you know, like I said, not that it's rocket science for a lot of these drivers. You can figure these things out. It's not that hard to figure them out. But I think that extra complexity, you know, and drivers, I think one big thing is that a lot of times when the employees are making decisions, they sort of expect drivers to do certain things because maybe it's the right thing or maybe it's the thing that benefits the most number of people. But honestly, it's not the sexiest thing to say, but drivers, when they work harder, they want to be paid more for it, right? Or even feel like they're being paid more for it. And that hasn't always happened.
Mm-hmm. So I want to pull on one of the threads that you just mentioned, which is that, you know, it's a pain to be able to drop off and pick up passengers. This is sort of one of my pet issues, which is why Pete's laughing at, is that when I was a driver, one of the things that I had thought of back then was, you know, we should have these easy pickup and drop off zones. There's no home for rideshare on our streets. So I've been, constantly on a crusade to create shared use mobility zones or some zones that would sort of give rideshare that home on the streets, allowing for easy pickups and drop-offs. Because I think that a lot of the frustration with drivers, and one of the things that contributes a lot to congestion, is people who are double parked. That's 33% of congestion is caused by non-recurring incidents like that. Have you given thought to that? Have you heard of any interest in that from drivers and sort of having these pickup drop-off locations or anything like that?
Yeah, definitely. I would say from night one as an Uber or Lyft driver, this is something that you probably realize would be very beneficial. Just because, you know, like you said, right, cities were not designed for massive amounts of drop-offs and pickups. It, you know, it doesn't take a huge study or survey to drive around in a busy area on a Friday or Saturday night and just look out and see dozens, if not hundreds, of Uber and Lyft vehicles. And they're doing a lot of the things that contribute to congestion, right? Just like you said, right? Double parking, driving around in LA and San Francisco, in these big cities, it's hard to find a parking spot, yeah, right? And so when I'm in between fares, what am I going to do? I'm going to drive around. I would much rather park. And you can sort of see this when your Uber or Lyft driver drops you off at your destination. What do? They usually drive off. They don't usually pull over and park. Although if they read my stuff, that's what I recommend. But more though to save, you know, on the mileage, you know, so you're not putting extra miles on your car. But that's what I would say 90% plus of drivers are doing. And so they're taking a lot of actions that are definitely contributing to congestion. That's why when I see people sort of talking about autonomous vehicles saving Uber and Lyft, or, you know, self-driving cars, I sort of think to myself, okay, there's so many things right now that human drivers have to handle. So they need to figure out that whole technology side of things, but then they need to develop all the systems that would allow for pickups and drop-offs, right? If you have a self-driving car that has to follow all the rules, they're never going to drop off any passengers because there's nowhere to drop them off, right?
Yeah, no, I'm picturing any of the autonomous vehicles that you see, even the kind of demo ones now, trying to navigate the departure lane at any airport, where you basically, it's just a constant stream of people cutting each other off. And, you know, if we are trying to encourage a much more shared mobility, autonomous world away from drive your personal vehicle in and park it in the city, we need to, as you said, cities are not being designed for large amounts of pickup and drop off.
And you know, the thing that's a little bit frustrating for me is that this stuff is not that hard to test. It's actually quite easy. You know, I know, you know, to give a little kudos to one city, I know in San Diego, for example, in the Gas Lamp, where they, you know, which is sort of the busy area where everyone goes out Friday, Saturday night, you do have, they are testing just simple zones where they remove a few parking spots. And late at night, when, you know, the 2 a.m. bar rush happens and everyone wants to go home, Uber and Lyft drivers can just roll up and park there and pick them up, right? So it's pretty easy to test this stuff. I mean, even here in my home city of Santa Monica, where they've had a lot of issues with the Bird scooters, it took them 9 months to paint a few stencils on the ground. to say, hey, put your scooters here, right? And sort of when I see these things, you know, I've been charging, I don't know if you know, but I've been charging for Bird too and trying that out. And, you know, when I see these things taking so long to develop, it's a little disheartening for me because, I mean, there's pretty simple things I think you can do now that can at least sort of, you know, help a lot of different people for sure.
So, Harry, I'd love to hear your take as a driver on the new kind of dockless e-scooters and also what you're seeing in terms of the market change, particularly on those shorter trips in the city, you know, in Santa Monica and in LA where these scooters are active.
I think there's a few points on the e-scooters, which is definitely an area that I'm super interested in. I think is really fascinating because I think there are actually a lot of real benefits to first and last mile. And, you know, I think Uber and Lyft have kind of touted how they can help with a lot of these issues in the past. But I think, you know, what I see with e-scooters is that there's a lot of legitimacy there. And, you know, even though there's been a lot of hype and buzz, I think there's going to be even more. And I think what we're seeing on the sort of TNC driver side is there isn't a tangible kind of feeling that there are less short trips these days. But like you said, short trips are actually not that profitable for drivers. Uber and Lyft take a fee off of every short trip. So we call them minimum fares. So any fare that's 2 to 3 miles or less is basically going to be a minimum payout. So you get paid the same as a driver, whether it's only, you know, basically one block or even 2.5 miles. And so there is a lot of waiting and there's a lot of driving to the passenger and even waiting for that passenger to come down that you don't get paid for. And so you could imagine that the longer the trip, you know, that sweet spot might be more of a 20 to 30 minute trip. Whereas the short trips, Uber and Lyft actually take an extremely high commission. It's typically over 50% because they take a fee. Let's say it's a $7 minimum fare to the passenger. They take a $2.50 fee, which leaves $4.50 for the driver, which the driver only gets 75% of that. So you're basically looking at a few dollars for quite a bit of time, miles, and you know, that you kind of have to spend on these minimum fares. And so I don't think we're seeing a huge impact, or at least a tangible impact yet. I think Uber has released some numbers that says that people are replacing short trips with jump bike trips, which makes sense. And I'm sure scooters will be the same. But I think it actually may end up being somewhat of a benefit to drivers because it wasn't the best use of their time and it wasn't something that made them a ton of money. And so my hope is that, you know, Uber and Lyft will do a good job of, you know, for example, on those longer or medium trips is basically kind of rewarding drivers. So it's not that, you know, okay, now we take away these short trips where drivers didn't like them and we sort of replace some other aspect where, you know, now we're going to make the experience not as positive, right? I think I want to see, like, as these benefits come to drivers, you know, whether it's new products or new innovative services, I think it should be more of a win-win-win for everyone.
It wouldn't be a mobility podcast without talking about autonomous vehicles. You know, you addressed this in your book. The reason Uber and Lyft are so excited about autonomous vehicles is because you guys are expensive, is, you know, kind of how it's
framed. Definitely.
And so I'm curious, you know, is this something that keeps drivers up at night at all, or used to, but maybe not so much after recent events? What is your take on AVs and the driver?
Yeah, so I think one of the interesting things is that Uber and Lyft, you know, they feel like drivers are their biggest expense, and that's why they've invested into so much into autonomous. But really, when you talk to drivers and ask them what their number one complaints are and why they're actually quitting these services, it's because pay. They feel that they're not paid enough. So I think you kind of have an interesting situation where Uber and Lyft feel they're paying drivers too much, and drivers feel they're not getting paid enough, which, you know, typically isn't going to be the healthiest relationship when you have two people at kind of those different ends of the spectrum. But I think, as far as, you know, sort of how drivers feel about autonomous vehicles today, and I think I mentioned this in my book, is that really a lot of drivers, you know, they have short-term needs. They're thinking about the bills that they have to pay today. There was a recent outage of Uber's instant pay feature last weekend where drivers couldn't cash out. And you wouldn't believe the number of emails and messages and really just pissed off people that we were hearing from, because they say, hey, you know, I need this money today, right? I have expenses today. Like, you know, I mean, some people were like, more pissed than I've seen in a long, long time. You know, so I think when you think about it in that perspective and like what a driver really cares about, it's more short-term needs, whereas AVs are definitely more medium to long-term. And I think that for a lot of drivers who aren't looking at this, I mean, frankly, I think you'd be pretty naive as a driver to think that this is going to be like a very stable and solid 10, 15, 20-year career where there's growth opportunities. I don't think a lot of drivers really think about it like that. And maybe when you look out on the AV timeline, maybe it's somewhere in that ballpark. But I think also you have a tendency for drivers to really, they're kind of on my page too. And they think that there's a lot that they probably even think that there's more that they do, you know, than just the examples I cited that, you know, that Uber and Lyft would have to figure out as far as AVs, you know, who's going to handle when that rider pukes in the back of your car. I think drivers definitely.
The fleet management.
And I mean, when you look out, I mean, Uber has not done the greatest job at fleet management so far. They had a program called Uber Exchange Leasing where they rented out vehicles to drivers, and it ended up being reported that they lost $9,000 on every single car. And I think they did, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands. And so I'm sure that that's millions or tens of millions, or it's so much money, I can't even do the math in my head that they lost on their sort of first iteration of fleet management. So it's not something that is easy in the first place. And then I think also, of course, when you do it at scale, it's even more challenging.
I'm curious, if you were made CEO of Uber or Lyft for, you know, for the day, what would be the one big policy change you would institute that would dramatically improve the experience and the kind of industry from the driver's perspective?
I think actually requiring everyone, at least on the driver's team, if not, you know, beyond that scope at Uber, to go out and actually drive for Uber, drive for Lyft, and do it, you know, you don't need to do it every single week or even every single day. But I think putting some hours in behind the road would definitely allow for a few things. I think it would help them better understand their products and the incentives, but I think it would also just help them to empathize with a lot of drivers, because I think what you have is a situation where, first, Uber was a company that was really started by guys who wanted a better way of hailing for a ride. These were not taxi drivers fed up with a system who, you know, wanted to disrupt everything on that side. It was more on the consumer side. And I think that line of thinking has really propagated down throughout the years, whereas Lyft was a little bit of a different approach. They were a little bit more of a shared experience, right? Your friend with a car, not your personal driver. And I think that that really shows with drivers. A lot of them feel like Lyft is the friendlier company. They may make more money and get more rides with Uber, but a lot of drivers prefer driving for Lyft. And the numbers in our survey show this too. So I think that really forcing drivers, you know, whether you're at Uber, or forcing employees, whether you're at Uber or Lyft, to go out and drive and to go out and do these services. You know, when you think about it, most employees at these companies right now, since they all get free credit, I mean, Pete, you worked at Uber, so you know you got a bunch of free credit when you work at Uber, and that's one of the perks in addition to the free food, right? You know, most of the employees at these companies, I'd say 90% plus of their interactions are going to be on the customer side. You know, they might get to talk to a driver here and there, but they're not actually doing it. And so I think when you're always experiencing things from the customer consumer side, that tends to bias, you know, your product decisions or your roadmap or whatever you're working on, whether you realize it or not. So I think that that's the type of policy I'd definitely install.
I think we've run out of time, but I could go on for hours. And I think we're going to definitely have to have Harry back, because it, you know, this viewpoint and these insights, I think, are really missing in the broader, not only the corporate discussion, but more importantly, from the policy side. When we talk about traffic congestion and kind of just yelling at Uber doesn't change anything, when you, if you're not really putting ourselves in the driver's shoes and seeing, you know, yeah, it's not that I enjoy double parking. It's that I'm under a rating system that requires me to, you know, to be at the beck and call of this, of a passenger. So I think it's a really important angle. I want to thank Harry for coming out. Can't plug his book enough. It was a very quick and awesome read, and I really did learn a lot about what it's like being on the other side of the transaction. Please go out and get the Rideshare Guide, everything you need to know about driving for Uber, Lyft, and other ride-sharing companies.
Harry, if people want to learn more about what you're writing or follow what you're writing, where should they go? Do you have a website and social media?
Yeah, definitely. So you can find me on Twitter at the Rideshare Guy. I'm a prolific tweeter, as as you guys may know.
Sure. And
not always about rideshare mobility, but really just whatever pops into my head. So it can be annoying. But then also, I've got a blog at therideshareguy.com, the book, as you guys mentioned. And then also, I've got a podcast of my own where we interview kind of quite a range of different folks. So everyone from drivers to reporters and academics and people, you know, even sort of the actual people working at these companies. So definitely a wide ranging variety of guests there. But basically, just type the Rideshare Guy into any box and I should pop up.
Yeah. If you just search GNC driver in Google, you'll probably pop up within a few results too. It's pretty impressive. Pete, where can people find you online, and what are you looking forward to in this next month or so?
Find me at Shared Mobility S on Twitter. And what am I looking forward to most? You know, I think that I'm really fascinated to see how more and more of these mobility pilots, particularly as we're seeing it in the scooter world, how it starts to actually play out in real life. And as the seasons start to change, I'll be fascinated to see the usage patterns and all of that as, you know, we kind of get into those months where people are talking about, you know, well, but how are you going to ride a bike or ride a scooter when it's X degrees out? So that's what I'm looking forward to. What about you, Greg?
Anyone can follow me on Twitter at AVGregR, at Mobility Podcast for everything that we're doing. I will be at the NAMIC Future of Auto Summit. This will be with a ton of folks from the insurance industry. October 9th and 10th in Ann Arbor. So if anyone's in that area or you're going, give me a shout. We also have some exciting events going on in DC coming up soon with Car Talk DC. So keep an eye on Twitter and we'll be sharing those too.
And Harry, what are you looking forward to the most in the next few months?
I would say that I'm looking forward to, I guess similarly, you know, I've been very interested in the whole e-scooter phase. So I think it will be interesting to see the usage patterns. But I think also, you know, one of the articles we published we've got a new monthly mobility report that we're publishing right now that just went live today. And one of the things that I think is really interesting is sort of the regulatory approach to these companies. I think in the past, Uber and Lyft have always had their way. And now it seems like cities are sort of have gained a little bit of insight, maybe a little bit more bravado, and they're sort of starting to push back. You know, the first time New York City pushed against Uber didn't go too well. The second time they won, and cities are obviously looking at scooters with a wary eye. And so, I'm curious to see if this was just maybe a few lucky ones, or if the cities are kind of developing a pattern, you know, or maybe a new game plan.
I'm also very much looking forward to see how the two relatively smaller scooter companies that San Francisco selected because they didn't, you know, pull the stuff that Uber and Lyft and Bird had in the past. I'm fascinated to see if they're able to actually execute at scale. That'll be very interesting. All right. Well, guys, thank you so much, Harry. It was great. And if you're in LA, please reach out to Harry because he's a great guy. And this has been a fascinating conversation. And I promise you the first of several conversations with Harry.
Absolutely. Thanks, Harry.
Thanks for having me.